For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Tony Parsons tells us how he feels about being dubbed the father of manlit.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of labels because I think that you miss out on something when you're reading labels when you could be actually reading the book, maybe.
With the stage version of Alice Always about to open in London, Harriet Lane explains how sight loss enabled her to become an author.
Suddenly finding myself ill, I was also dealing with the fact that I was no longer writing, and it was a big ache.
Phil Jupitus reveals the perils of listening to audiobooks while driving.
Philip Pullman reading his books out. I mean, they're brilliant and they're amazing, but as soon as he says pantomime, I'm asleep.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Rock journalist, newspaper columnist, TV broadcaster and best-selling author, Tony Parsons has been them all. In a career spanning five decades, he continues to reflect on modern life from street level rather than from the lofty ideals that we so often fail to live up to. Since the overnight success of Man and Boy in the year 2000, his books have given the male point of view on parenthood, relationships and heartbreak, and shown that even middle-aged boys can cry. More recently, he's reinvented himself as a crime writer, beginning with The Murder Bag, which Lee Child described as spectacular. With the fourth book in the series out now, and the sequel to Man and Boy about to enter the Talking Books library, I was delighted when Tony Parsons invited me round for a cup of tea and to talk about his life as a writer. Tony, welcome to Read On.
Thanks for having me.
So, rereading Man and Boy, I was struck by just how little things have changed and how pertinent it is. Do you think much has changed being a male parent in the last 17 years?
I don't think so. I mean, it's quite old, that book now. You know, as you say, it's knocking on for its 20th anniversary. And I think, if anything, the themes of the book have become more relevant. I mean, I wrote it at the time when my mother was dying and my son was growing up fast. And for the first and really the last time in my life, I felt poised between two generations. I felt very much somebody's son and somebody's father. I felt really, you know, as part of the sandwich generation. And I think as people's parents are living longer, And maybe their children are staying at home longer, the sandwich generation has increased in bandwidth over those last 20 years. So I think it's, I mean, there was a big gap between the man my father was. He was a World War II veteran and very much an old school patriarch, and the kind of guy that I was, and my experiences of growing up in a time of peace and prosperity and sex and drugs and rock and roll. But I think there's less of a gap now between the parents of today and their children. So I think it's it was a book that I wrote really as therapy when my mum was dying of cancer, and it was my way of dealing with her illness and losing her. And I think its themes are pretty much universal and timeless.
And I think your protagonist, Harry Silver, his father is a very dignified man. And actually, Harry only really achieves dignity after the loss of his father. It's almost as if he has to undergo that suffering to realise exactly what life is.
My father and his generation had a kind of enforced maturity. And if anything, we're encouraged to stay adolescents these days until we're about 50 or beyond, you know, the Jeremy Clarkson genes that we squeeze our aging bodies into. So I think but life has a way of making you grow up. You know, like, you can't really duck that stuff. You can't duck the hard stuff.
When I first read the book, I'd just become a new father. And what I loved is that there was a male voice articulating my thoughts. And I know that you have been dubbed the father of manlit, but I think it goes deeper than that. Does the manlit label bother you at all?
Yeah, I don't like any labels. I don't like any labels at all because I think they're all, you know, they're all so broad as to be almost meaningless. I mean, I can understand, you know, the need for them. But I just, I'm not a big fan of labels because I think that, you miss out on something when you're reading labels when you could be actually reading the book, maybe.
And a lot of people thought that Man and Boy was your first novel, but actually I think you wrote your first novel, The Kids, in 1976?
Yeah, I left school at 16 and I knew I wanted to write and I thought if I wrote a novel and got it published, then I would certainly, nobody could dispute the facts that I was a writer. So, you know, most books, as you know yourself, it's largely an act of will. It's like they're like, writing a book is like running a marathon. It's really, you know, of course, talent is helpful, as Hemingway said, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is getting through it. The main thing is going back to your desk day after day for a long time. And even a short book takes a long time to write. So I wrote I was working in Gordon's Gin Distillery, which is the factory that Gordon's Gin, very famous gin manufacturer, of course, they used to have on the City Road in Islington. And I worked there before my first job in journalism. And I worked on the night shift. So we were largely unsupervised for 12 hours at night, from 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning. They would fill us full of free gin and then just let us loose for 12 hours. And there was a lot of downtime. There was a lot of free time. And I used that to write my novel. And it really wasn't a very good book. It was quite a poor book. It was kind of typical of the kind of stuff that you write when you're young and, you know, gets left in a drawer somewhere. But the difference with me was that, you know, I was very, I'm not sure if ambition is the right word, but I was just determined to push it through, to push it all the way to the end of the process. So I wrote the book, and the toughest thing was finding an agent. That was harder than the agent finding a publisher. So it took years, you know, it took years from the initial writing of the book to finding an agent to getting it published. But it eventually got published, and that got me my first job in journalism. And I had no idea about the economics of books. I thought, you know, I'd have enough money to live, you know, on my own private island somewhere in the Caribbean if I had a book published. And of course, it wasn't like that. You know, I got 700 quid for it. But I always had this feeling, I just felt in my blood and my bones, that if I got a book published, then I would always be a writer. And funny enough, it did turn out like that because it got me my first job in journalism, and then you know, everything led on from that. Because it was quite impressive to when the NME advertised for new writers and people were sending in their little, you know, biro scribbled Bruce Springsteen reviews or their little chippy tappy typewriter reviews of Patti Smith, and I sent them a published book. So they didn't read it, you know, they didn't read it. They didn't need to read it. It was just, wow, this, you know, this guy in the gin distillery has got a book published. And so it was quite impressive because, you know, a lot of them, yeah, they haven't had a book published now, 40 years later. So it was quite impressive. But it is, I think I always understood that it was largely an act of will, you know, that, and it is that for, you know, for aspiring writers. I think, you know, it's always important to remember that it's just, you know, digging in. You have to just keep going and not put off. I mean, classic example is J.K. Rowling, who was, you know, turned down by a dozen publishers in London. I mean, everything, you know, the smart money would have said, this is not for you. Think of something else. Stop. You're just inflicting misery on yourself. Give it up. And she didn't give it up. And that's why she, you know, she's changed children's literature and made billions and, you know, changed the face of popular fiction. So it's largely just digging in and keeping going. And I think I understood that early on. You know, I think because I came from a background where people didn't have careers, you know, they had jobs. You know, my family, my dad was a greengrocer. Nobody had careers in my family. They had jobs. And so I didn't expect it to be easier. Never expected the world to be waiting for me or waiting to read my book. You know, I knew that it was probably going to be much tougher than that.
And do you have those days where you sit in front of the word processor and nothing comes out? Or are you a fortunate writer who always manages to get something down on paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand, you know, Hemingway, it's very good on the self-help for writers. Hemingway says you should always leave something in the well, meaning that you know, when I go to my desk tomorrow, I know I've got something to work on. I've got something to work on. There's something in the well already to draw on. So even on the worst of days, you can get started. You can make a go of it. And, you know, you can't really have writer's block and make a living out of it. Mm. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work if you can get nothing out. So you have good days and bad days. And you know, I'm quite a long way into my career now. I've been doing this for a while. And so I know that there are going to be hard days. I know that there are going to be difficult times when you need to drag it out. But, I mean, over the last few years, I've been writing a book a year for the last 5 years. And you do understand the techniques to make it work. You know that you learn the best time of day to write. You know the conditions that you want to write in. You know how much exercise you need, how much fresh air you need, putting good things into your body and, you know, just having a good attitude to it, not being too down when it's tough, when it's hard. And those moments you hit a brick wall, just, you know, learn for ways to get around that brick wall. You know, you learn these things with time, I think. They're hard-earned lessons. So I do have very tough days, and I do have days where I have longer than days, like weeks and months, where I think this book is not where it needs to be. But the thing is, I can recognise that it's not where it needs to be. It's not as good as I want it to be. It's not the book that's in my head and in my heart. It's not that book. The book that I've got on page is weaker than that. It's more mediocre than that. So I know I've got to put the hours in, and I'm always ready to put the hours in. You know, I'm always ready to put the time in.
One of the other things that I admire about you is that you're not afraid to reinvent yourself. I was going to ask you whether there's Harry Silver Becomes a Grandfather book ahead, but also you've left Harry Silver for a bit and you've moved to crime fiction.
Yeah, I was at a screening in 2010 and things were kind of winding down for me with the, you know, post Man and Boy. I mean, it was such an enormous success, and it was this kind of success that any writer dreams of, you know, kind of commercial success that any writer dreams of. And you can never regret that or be sad that it happened. But it does push your career in a certain direction, which you wouldn't necessarily have gone in. And I wouldn't necessarily, if Man and Boy had just sold reasonably, I wouldn't necessarily have written more books about families and relationships and all that stuff. Probably wouldn't have done it. I'd probably done something completely different. But because it made so much money for so many people and it sold so many millions of copies, I was kind of, you know, locked into that for a good 10 years. You know, you're locked into it. You just sort of picked up by the momentum of it. And also it's scary when you get off the roller coaster, because, you know, I said to my agent a few years ago, what I really want to write is thrillers. I want to write thrillers with heart. And he said, well, he said, I think you do that well. And he's a very honest man. He said, but you're going to have to start again. And what he meant was, you know, I'd need a new publisher. I'd need a publisher to choose me again. He didn't spell it out for me, but it seemed to me obvious that I'd need to write it without a contract. So I would need to, you know, cash in my life savings. I'd need to gamble all that money, all the money that I'd accumulated. I'd have to invest that in myself, because you can't, if my old publisher had published it half-heartedly or kind of indulging me, it would have been the kiss of death. It would have definitely failed. It would have definitely failed. And I couldn't afford to do that. I needed it to be a success. And it was really, I was at a screening in 2010, and it was a screening organised by Sam Mendes, who had written to me about Man and Boy, how much he liked Man and Boy. And I don't know Sam Mendes, but we kind of stayed in touch, and he invited me to this screening of a film called The Kids Are All Right, which was a small film that he felt people weren't going to see, and he felt that more people should know about it. It wasn't a film that he was involved in, although it starred Annette Bening, who was in American Beauty, of course. And we were just having a glass of wine, and what are you doing, what are you up to? And he said, oh, next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to direct the next James Bond movie, which, of course, you know, 7 years on, with hindsight, seems like a good career move for Sam Mendes, because he did it so brilliantly. But at the time, it was, wow, you know, the director of American Beauty and the Donmar Warehouse doing James Bond, that's a bit of a shock. And he started talking about how much he'd loved the Ian Fleming books when he was a kid. And, Yeah, and how important they'd been to him. And he was going to try and capture whatever it was he loved in those books, because he didn't think it had ever been done before. And I knew exactly what he meant. You know, I knew exactly what he meant, because I'd loved those books too. And, you know, nothing in Roger Moore or James Bond or any of the, even Sean Connery, nothing had captured the essence, that kind of gritty essence in the Ian Fleming books. So he said, my preparation for this film is I'm going to reread all the books and just try and capture that. And I came home that night and I thought, what a wonderful thing for a middle-aged man to do, to reread all those terrific books again. I'm going to do that. And I picked up a copy of Casino Royale. By the time I was off the first page, I knew that I wanted to write a serious hero. I knew I wanted to have a crack at creating a hero of my own. And because it just seems to me that, you know, we don't think of Ian Fleming as a great writer, but it seems we don't think of Arthur Conan Doyle as a great writer, or Agatha Christie, or Raymond Chandler. Maybe Raymond Chandler we do. But the people that have created Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson and James Bond and Philip Marlowe and Jack Reacher, we don't think of them as like the supreme writers, but there's something incredible about creating a hero that still means something 100 years later. So I thought I wanted a crack at it. I just felt that this is the thing that I'd really love to do now. And, you know, I discussed it with Yuriko, discussed it with my wife. You know, it would mean cashing in my savings. It would mean gambling that. And so it was... And giving myself the time to do it right, because I knew I needed a couple of years really to do the first one. And it was kind of scary. I mean, I'd lost my job as a newspaper columnist at the Daily Mirror after 18 years. I lost that just as I was completing the book. So kind of everything ended. Suddenly everything ended, you know. And certainly, you know, when Man and Boy came out and was number one, and you just kind of think, oh, well, this is what my life's going to be like now. You know, this is the level of success that I will always enjoy. And then suddenly 20 years later, you realize, actually, no, not necessarily. Yeah, you might fall off the mountain. And in fact, you almost certainly will. So it was just one of those things. I think books find us, you know, books find writers. You know, it wasn't as though I had lots of options. I had lots of ideas about what to do next. I didn't. I had just this one idea I wanted to write about this this detective called Max Wolfe, who lived in Smithfield opposite the meat market and worked in West End Central in Homicide and Serious Crime Command as a murder detective. I wanted to write about him, and I knew that he'd have a small daughter, and he'd have a dog called Stan, and I just had his world mapped out. But it was scary, and, you know, I hope I never have to do it again, because it was so much riding on it. It's not like, you know, when I wrote Man and Boy, you know, I wrote it as therapy. It didn't really need, you know, I hoped people would like it. I hoped that a few people would buy it. But I didn't need it to be a success. Whereas with The Murder Bag, which is the first Max Wolfe book, I needed it to be a success. I needed it to be a success because I just gambled so much of my life and what I'd achieved on that. And, it, you know, thankfully it worked out. Sold it in 24 hours to a publisher who I'd never met, Penguin Random House. You know, went to number one, so it works out, but it's not something I look forward to doing again anytime soon. Sort of Man was the second one, the third one was The Hanging Club, the fourth one, Die Last, came out a couple of weeks ago, so, and I'm working on the fifth now, so I'm doing six, and we'll see after that. I was just going to do three, you know, my model was really Stieg Larsson did three, and seemed to have quite an impact with that. I can certainly remember, you know, being on beaches 10 years ago and just everybody was reading Stieg Larsson. Everybody was reading it. And I thought, wow, I can remember going to a beach and everybody was reading Man and Boy. So, you know, so there's always one book there's reading or one writer they're reading and on the beach. So, yeah, so I thought I'd do three. I wanted to do three and they were successful. So I'm doing another three. After that, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think it's, you know, it would be presumptuous for me to say there'll be more after that, because there has to be an appetite at the publishing house. There has to be an appetite among the readers, and there has to be some appetite in me too. So I don't know. 66 years, it feels like a lot. You know, I'm kind of, I do feel like a marathon runner, you know, entering the stadium on wobbly legs, you know, on the fifth book. I'm not sure I fancy another marathon.
Thanks, Tony. Man and Boy is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB 12422, and the Talking Book version of its sequel, Man and Wife, has just joined it as TB 23920. For a full list of Tony Parsons books in accessible formats, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
Almost 2 million people in the UK are living with sight loss.
Author Sarah Waters on supporting Talking Books.
When you lose your sight, it's easy to feel like you've lost everything. Reading unlocks virtually everything we do in life. Not being able to read means you lose the ability to read for necessity and for pleasure. RNIB's Talking Books helps people find their lives again. Unfortunately, less than 5% of books are in a format accessible to blind and partially sighted people. It costs RNIB £4 million a year to run the Talking Book service. This wouldn't be possible without your help. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
My name is Alex Saunders and I work for the Evidence and Service Impact Team. Thanks to funding from the Big Lottery Fund, RNIB, Action for Blind People and the University of Birmingham have been able to work together in an innovative partnership on how we can improve the employment prospects of blind and partially sighted people.
My name's Wendy, I'm 25. My eye condition is glaucoma and diabetic retinopathy.
Over the next few weeks in this course, I'm hoping to get a lot more confident and basically learn how to do an interview if I get an interview and how to apply for a job and hopefully at the end of it get a job.
With the right kind of support and the right kind of intervention, you can help individuals to move towards employment.
The job that I'm going for is to work in a laundrette. Before I'd done this course, I wouldn't have even thought about going out and looking for work, just waiting for it to come to me. It's actually really helped me.
Wendy got the job that she applied for, so we're all very excited. For more information about the pre-employment programme or any of our employment services, please visit the RNIB website at rnib.org.uk/employment or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
A conversation with narrator Rachel Atkins.
I was a member, I think a lot of people here have been, a member of the Radio Drama Company, which was my rep, really, my theatre rep, because by the time I left drama school, most repertory theatres had shut. And some said, did you ring? I had to ring quite a few times before I was allowed in, but very strict. Professionals only, so obviously I didn't sound that professional. But my most memorable, my best read, I think, for me, the book I really, really enjoyed reading and didn't think I would enjoy reading was a science fiction book called Never Let Me Go by the Japanese writer Ishiguro, who'd wrote Remains of the Day. And it was a brilliant read and something, you know, when you enter into something, you think, oh, I don't want to read this. And it was so beautifully but so simply written. But it was a wonderful read and I really, really enjoyed that. And then started to read a lot of his other books.
I won't be a carer any more come the end of the year, and though I've got a lot out of it, I have to admit I'll welcome the chance to rest, to stop and think and remember. I'm sure it's at least partly to do with that, to do with preparing for the change of pace, that I've been getting this urge to order all these old memories. What I really wanted, I suppose, was to get straight all the things that happened between me and Tommy and Ruth after we grew up and left Hailsham. But I realise now just how much of what occurred later came out of our time at Hailsham, and that's why I want first to go over these earlier memories quite carefully, Take all this curiosity about Madame, for instance. At one level, it was just us kids larking about. But at another, as you'll see, it was the start of a process that kept growing and growing over the years until it came to dominate our lives.
I got a letter from somebody from the RNIB, I think Isabel Shippey sent it to me, and it was a man who said, "Normally, I hate female readers, but I quite like you." Which was quite nice.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Phil Jupitus introduces us to his favourite books, but before that... Both Harriet Lane novels, Alice Always and Her, have been runaway successes, but she only became an author because of a career break brought on by her sight loss. As our reporter Ellie Jacobs found out when Harriet came to the RNIB studios.
You were a journalist for many years before you were an author, and I actually think that comes across in both the novels. Both protagonists are observers to some extent, onlookers. Mm. Do you think that that's a quality that either many journalists have or that you picked up as a journalist and that helped you to write?
Well, I was a features journalist. I did a lot of interviews. I was always interested in people and... So that's quite a sort of specific skill set. In a way, it's quite different from being a news journalist. I wouldn't know how to write a news story.
Yeah.
But I was always interested in people and, you know, and if I could get into their houses, that was always, you know, it happened less and less. I kind of gave up journalism in 2005. But before that, I was working at various newspapers. And before that, I was at Tatler. And, you know, and you used to get amazing access. You know, I remember going through Elizabeth Hurley's bathroom cabinet. But getting to people's houses says so much about them. And so sometimes when I'm writing, I remember that sort of sensation of, because anyway, when you're reading a feature, an interview with someone, you want to know, you know, how they live, what they're like, what the stuff they choose to surround themselves, what it says about them. So, yeah, that's definitely a technique that I use in the fiction.
Obviously, there are differences between journalistic writing and writing fiction. Do you think there are any similarities?
I mean, it's kind of weird because I suppose with journalism, you've got a very short space of time to convey information, and you can't afford to be to leave things up to the reader. Whereas with fiction, I think that's what I like to do, is to kind of leave enough space for the readers to fill in the gap, so that you feel kind of engaged as a reader. That's essential with my fiction, I think. In terms of, I think, yes, both are about conveying character. That's really, I think, what my journalism was about. And I think it's the same with my fiction. I think the fiction is all about, it's less about plot and it's all about character.
I really like the way that you delve so deeply into the character's psyches, especially in Her, where the novel continually shifts between Emma and Nina's perspectives. Did you find it difficult to write from both their perspectives, almost about similar events, but told through such different lenses?
That's a good question. No, actually, I remember the sort of feeling of realising that it was a sort of accelerant almost to the writing, because I'd have a scene and the story's written from the perspective of Emma, who is a kind of, she's embroiled, she's with her young family, she's lost her career, really, she's put it on hold while she has her young children at home. She's missing her career. She's finding herself sort of struggling to find a new identity. And then there's Nina, who's the same age, but at a very different sort of stage of life. Her child is much older, in some ways kind of doesn't need her so much. And so Nina's at a loose end. She's very successful creatively, but you get this sense that she's trying to find a way to fill that gap, perhaps, that her daughter's absence has left her with. So you'd have a scene written from Emma's perspective, and then you could flip it and come at it from Nina's perspective. And so you, again, it's like having, I had the framework and all I had to do was to write the character into that framework. And it was really, it felt like a very fast way to write, because I'd have the plot and then I could reproduce it. It drives some people, some readers nuts, I know. They kind of go, oh, so, you know, it's difficult, you know, dreary going through the same thing again. But actually, there is so much difference to the way that the two people experience the same events, which I think is really... tells you a great deal about them as individuals.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with that. Also, I found I was so gripped because, you know, you were heading to the climax, but you didn't know from whose perspective it was going to be.
Yeah. It's true. And also, there's a kind of thrill, isn't there, in seeing how something which seems so innocent to one person, you suddenly realise when you read the other alternative version, you go, oh, so that was going on all the time, you know, and you didn't necessarily see it immediately.
Completely. You really see the layers. You get beneath the veneer that people kind of try and give across. And
it's true, isn't it? I mean, and, you know, I'm sure you've had the same experience of talking about an evening out with friends or an encounter or something, and you have these conversations and you realise they've seen something, you know, they've missed it all. Or they saw something completely different. And it's really weird. It's like, that's just the way that people are. You know, we all see different stuff.
Yeah. As well as that, there's this very strong sense of place in your books that clearly reflects your life in North London. Reminded me of Zadie Smith almost, how she kind of really encapsulates London and especially North London. Do you think that any of your acquaintances would recognise themselves in your works?
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, weirdly, I've had sort of various people have come at me quite cross, good friends or even family members have come at me quite cross saying, oh, how could you do that? And it's just totally taken me there. They've seen themselves in a character. Or in a setup, both times it absolutely floored me because it totally is not, you know, I don't recognise it when I read it. I think there's a sort of weird hunger sometimes for people to see themselves reflected back. But oddly, the people who are in it have not said anything. Possibly they just haven't read the books, so that's fine. I won't say any more about that because I'll get into trouble.
And how do you write? Do you write every day? Do you have any rituals? Do you have to go to a special place in the woods to write?
Special place in the woods? No, I wish I did have a special place in the woods because then I'd be having probably more fun than I am at the moment. Actually, weirdly, I think I do have a study at home. It's so boring in there. It's really dull in my study. Plus, it's next door to the bathroom where the washing machine is. So I always feel this sort of terrible obligation / procrastination urge to go and do lots of laundry instead of writing. So kind of my study's useless. I do well in coffee shops, actually. There's something about, I think, because I like being surrounded by a sense of kind of life going on. I like the hubbub. I think it's probably connected to the fact that I used to work in lots of open plan newspaper offices. So, but I mean, I'm sort of in search for the, my life is sort of endless quest for the perfect coffee shop where I can just be left to get on with it.
And I read that you did a creative writing course. Were you at all into creative writing before? Did you write fiction?
I used to write a lot of stories at school and I loved it. And then as you get older, there's not really a space for it on the curriculum. And I got into journalism, which sort of seemed to scratch the itch that I had to write. And then that just took up all my time and I thought that was all, and that kept me happy. And then in 2005, out of the blue, I started to lose my sight with an autoimmune disorder. And there was a period of uncertainty when no one knew really what was happening. I was just in and out of hospitals a lot, having tests and treatments and things. And at that time, I parked the freelance journalism. At that point, I was freelancing mostly for The Guardian. So I rang up all my commissioning editors and said, I can't do any work for you at the moment and I'll let you know when I'm sort of back on the circuit. And so as well as suddenly finding myself ill, I was also dealing with the fact that I was no longer writing, and it was a big ache. After a while, I had nothing in my life apart from worry, and I needed to get out of my head. So I was really frightened, but I saw a little flyer for a lunchtime course, and it was, you know, I don't know, I turned up the first day, I was absolutely petrified because I probably knew at some deep level that I really wanted to enjoy this. I wasn't thinking that it was going to be the change that it subsequently turned out to be. I was hopeful, I was fearful because I suspected maybe I wouldn't be able to do it. I just needed somewhere, I think, to try and write again. And I remember that we had, you know, it was me and some retired people and a really good young American teacher. She gave us a writing exercise just to write for 5 minutes on a subject. I think she gave us the word cotton. She said, just write whatever comes into your head. And I can't really remember what I wrote, but I can remember the feeling of sort of excitement and relief again. For me, it is a pleasure when it's working. Or even when it's not, just writing often feels, it's just, I find it very, makes me happy.
The RNIB has an annual writing competition, and each year one thing that comes up is how hard it is for partially sighted authors to edit their own works. Is it more difficult to edit your own work?
What, kind of actually physically?
Yeah, physically.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good point, because it's not often... Yeah, you're right, no one's ever asked me that before. I do find it's frustrating because reading, yeah, I mean, dealing with page proofs and going back and finding things. Obviously, if you're on the computer, you can search, and that's so fast and fantastic. But yeah, when it actually comes down to printing out and going over page proofs, so slow and laborious. But that's at quite a late stage, I suppose. The actual editing process of self-editing, which happens before you submit the book. I know I'm slower. I'm just a slower reader than I used to be. Everything is just that much harder. But sometimes it makes you more painstaking, which can be a good thing. You don't rush. Mm. Can't afford to rush, you know. And when I read a book now, I really am reading every word, which I know I didn't, you know, that wasn't always the way. I used to kind of skim read a lot, because you can do that. You can just run your eye over a page and absorb lots of information. But if less information is getting through, you just have to slow down and be that much more sort of diligent. I think it's probably made me a better reader.
And how do you write? Do you write on a computer? Do you write with a pen?
What yeah, are your tools? No, on a computer. I mean, the illuminated screen is a fantastic thing. No, I don't write anything by longhand. My handwriting is getting worse and worse.
Do you listen to audiobooks?
You know, I'm ashamed to say I don't. I've got really into podcasts, so I'm kind of I feel like I'm in transition. There's something about, and I know it's a prejudice, and I've talked to enough people who are evangelical about audiobooks, which are obviously undergoing such a huge sort of renaissance, you know, within the wider community. I think when I'm reading, I like that sense of a voice kind of emerging in my own head, mm-hmm. something that emerges as you sort of get deeper into the book, the character becomes clear. I'm sort of scared about handing that over to someone else, but I understand that the right reader brings a lot. So I feel like I'm on the brink of committing and starting to, I think I have to find the right book and the right narrator, the right reader, and then go for it.
Do you think that you will always have women as your protagonists? Is that something you're
good
conscious
question,
of?
Good question, Ellie. Do you know what? I think so. I think maybe that's partly what I've been realising over the last year or so. Just, I've got to, you know, I know these women. Mm. They're familiar to me. There's lots to say about them, you know, these lives. So I think kind of difficult women, I think that's my bread and butter. Yeah, I'm going to stick with them.
I think that's what drew me so much towards the book as well. It's always great having a female.
And problematic people who aren't straightforward or good, you know. I remember ages ago, long time ago, reading a Barbara Vine, you know, maybe this was 20 years ago. And this kind of thrill when I realised that the narrator was a slow reveal. There's a lot that you take for granted when you're reading a book, and I think I played on that a lot with the Alice Always.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for R&IB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
Allow me to introduce you. Roland began, then interrupted himself. No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Woland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?" "Trousers don't suit cats, Messiah," replied the cat with great dignity. "Sit down and stop all this hot air." "Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it. but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Marcion Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself. Check, said Woland. Check it is, rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette. So, Woland turned to Margarita. Let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azaziello and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hella. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band.
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master and Margarita together and that they both loved it. It was going to be her birthday the following week. And he was taking her down to Dorset. And at a certain time on her birthday, they were going to be walking along a beach there. And he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in The Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that, just because you've recorded a book. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Comedian Phil Jupitus is a familiar presence on our radio and TV sets. He also appears regularly at music and book festivals around the country. Read On producer Robert Kirkwood caught up with him at the Wigtown Book Festival where, as you'll hear, Bill Drummond from the KLF was also doing a spot of performance art. Robert started by asking Phil Jupitus about the audio version of his book, Good Morning Nantwich, Adventures in Breakfast Radio.
It's very odd to kind of read the sort of a truncated version. I would have been incredibly happy to do the whole thing, you know, because it only would have taken a few days. I just think that with, particularly with, you know, with books that have got that kind of singular voice to them, you do want to do it yourself. And the edit as well, you know, there's the, if they just said to me, you know, if it's very easy. I was always very good at doing pre-seeing when I was doing English language at school. So editing it down, I'd much rather have done myself. But that was sort of never an option. Whereas if they just said, right, so you've got whatever, so you've got, you know, these 10, you know, or whatever it is, 16 5,000 word chapters, and you need to take each chapter down to 2,000 words, I could have done that. but I always forget that it's out there, really. It's an odd thing, but and reading your own essays out, it felt weirdly like school again, you know, because it's the only way that I could kind of approach writing a book was to treat it like I was at school again, you know, but in a, you know, on from the more enjoyable side, and the person marking it was me, and in a way, I was sort of more critical about it than I think anyone, any of the critics were, because it's weird sort of, you know, being in a position where someone will ask you to write a book just because of who you are. You're a name that they can put on the front of a book and presumably sell a few, whereas I actually had something to say about radio and the current state of radio in the UK as it was, you know, 6 years ago when the book was written. So, strange time.
Now, I know a lot of writers have really been quite angry about abridgments of their books. Or, is it something that you've managed to live with now, though?
Yeah, no, it's when, because that's what they have to do. It's they kind of think like an audiobook, 2.5 hours. But as your listeners know, they're very happy to kind of listen to the whole thing. And it's like, I always think that people, particularly, I know, I mean, you being, you know, associated, you know, with the blind, it's they're being deprived of a fuller version of it. And it's one of those things I'd sort of, But I think if I came back to it now, 6 years later, I'd be wanting to abridge the bugger.
Yeah. I think abridgement was so they could have two cassettes in a box.
Yeah, yeah.
Or one CD, but yeah. Because you can download them.
Well, this is it as well. And I mean the digital, digital age, you know, means that, you know, to download the full version of a book doesn't take any time at all. I remember getting a, we're near a wood shop.
It's Bill Drummond.
Is it Bill Drummond?
Yeah.
Oh my God, look at him. That is the sound of Bill Drummond hammering. That is amazing. This is the best heckle I've ever had. This is not someone making a bed. This is art terrorism you're listening to there, kids. Oh man. Anyway, so yeah, this is fabulous. So I think that the fact that you could, I'd always wanted to kind of read the whole thing out and sort of stick it online for free somewhere anyway, but obviously, you know, HarperCollins aren't having any of that.
Now, what was your first talk on today?
We went through sort of, it was kind of in a way almost like my sort of Desert Island Books, but it was just a look at half a dozen of my favourite books and authors, with Lee Randall, the journalist and author herself, and she's an old mate of mine, and we've always sort of talked quite sort of impassioned terms about writers and things that we like. And I think I've got a very immediate way of expressing ideas, which is when you're a stand-up comedian, you get a very kind of unvarnished and unconsidered way of expressing your thoughts. And it's very immediate and it's very blunt from that standpoint. And so the kind of luxury of writing is something that you kind of look at with a green eye. Certainly, it's like I could never imagine what it would be like to write. And when someone writes brilliantly, like, I mean, we talked about Raymond Chandler today and Dickens and Dorothy Parker and all sorts of people, you know, A.A. Milne even, you know, who I was first introduced to as a child. They're all very, very stylish writers. You could pick a paragraph of any of those writers' work and it would be immediately recognisable as them, I feel, you know. And I suppose that's what I like, is it almost, if you read it out loud, there was a bit today, I randomly picked a paragraph of Damon Runyon and read it out, and it got a massive laugh, just because there's just, it's so evocative, you know, of that New York of the 20s, that kind of villains arena, you know, those kind of characters that he's writing about are murderers and thugs and vandals and whores and drug addicts. And he just makes them sound so affable. It's extraordinary, really. And so, yeah, I suppose the theme that I recognise by picking my writers is I like the writers that in a way are performers. You know, there's an immediacy to them. Dickens certainly used to read his stuff out to crowds. And he was almost like James Brown. He used to come off stage and claps Dickens after readings. He was quite the show queen. So yeah. I like that. I'm drawn to it. I read a little excerpt from the Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens.
The first ray of light which illumines the gloom and converts into a dazzling brilliancy that obscurity in which the earlier history of the public career of the immortal Pickwick would appear to be involved is derived from the perusal of the following entry in the Transactions of the Pickwick Club, which the editor of these papers feels the highest pleasure in laying before his readers as a proof of the careful attention, indefatigable assiduity, and nice discrimination with which his search among the multifarious documents confided to him has been conducted. May the 12th, 1827... Joseph Smiggers, Esquire, PVPMPC, Perpetual Vice President, Member Pickwick Club, presiding. The following resolutions unanimously agreed to. That this association has heard read with feelings of unmingled satisfaction and unqualified approval the paper communicated by Samuel Pickwick, Esquire, GCMPC, General Chairman, Member Pickwick Club, entitled Speculations on the Source of the Hampstead Ponds, with some observations on the theory of tittlebats. And that this association does hereby return its warmest thanks to the said Samuel Pickwick, Esquire, GC, MPC, for the same.
I also was looking at the collected Dorothy Parker.
She wanted to be married. She was nearing 30 now, and she did not take the years well. She spread and softened, and her darkening hair turned her to inexpert dabblings with peroxide. There were times when she had little flashes of fear about her job. And she had had a couple of thousand evenings of being a good sport among her male acquaintances. She had come to be more conscientious than spontaneous about it.
And Damon Runyon, I mean, obviously, Guys and Dolls and Other Stories was the book that we read from today. We took a little bit from.
She keeps the letters in a big inlaid box in her room, Mr. Tuesday says, and if you just pick up this box and carry it away along with the silverware, no one will ever suspect that you are after the letters, but that you take the box thinking it contains valuables. You bring the letters to me and get your 10 G's, Mr. Tuesday says, and, he says, you can keep the silverware too.
Also, in terms of more modern writers, the American poet Billy Collins, I read from his collection Aimless Love, I've got to get the order right, is it Music, 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 Clothes, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. I think it's that order, by Viv Albertine. It may be Boys, Boys, Boys. I don't think Boys were first, I think Boys were last. It might have been Clothes, Clothes, Clothes before it was Music, Music, Music. But that book is, and you'll forgive me for saying, fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. So, yeah, it's... It was great to sort of read from that as well. And, of course, the collected sort of World of Pooh, which is the Winnie the Pooh and House at Pooh Corner collected edition. I'm still very, very fond of that book.
He hurried back to his own house, and his mind was so busy on the way with the hum that he was getting ready for Eeyore that when he suddenly saw Piglet sitting in his best armchair, he could only stand there rubbing his head and wondering whose house he was in. "Hello, Piglet," he said. "I thought you were out." "No," said Piglet. "It's you who are out, Pooh."
As a child, how did you consume Pooh?
A little moment there just for the listeners.
Yeah.
How did you... My mum read it to me at first, and so this is... So I was born in 62, and so as a young child in the 60s. This is the days before... audiobooks. I mean, as a parent in the 90s, my kids had, you know, little sort of cassette players in their bedrooms and listened to audiobooks. We had the Alan Bennett Winnie the Poohs and I think one of the Willie Rushton ones as well, you know. But I never had those as a kid, not even records when they came out. You know, by the time the idea of listening to someone reading, the idea of someone else reading stories out, you know, it was... I don't remember there being albums of people reading stories out being a very popular seller in record shops, but I think when cassettes came along and they were more portable, and then CDs, I think the rise of the audiobook in the last 20 years has been one of the most extraordinary things, you know. But although I have to say, I mustn't listen to them in cars because they're quite sort of soporific. Certainly, Philip Pullman reading his books out, I mean, they're brilliant and they're amazing, but as soon as he says Pantalaimon, I'm asleep. And he says her name quite early in that first book. And another author. I love authors when they read in their own voice. And so you can find a bit of Dorothy Parker online reading her stuff out, which is lovely. And there's a great American author who we didn't talk about today who writes really good non-fiction stuff called Sarah Vowell. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with her because she contributes to an NPR show in America called This American Life, which is really, really good. But she has a fabulous audiobook. It's one of those ones that I listen to a lot over and over again. I'm quite drawn to it. She has a very strange quality to her voice. She was the daughter in The Incredibles, for those of you that are film-minded out there. She did the voice for her. But Sarah Vowell's book, Assassination Vacation, is absolutely brilliant. And it's a very wittily told story of... It's the story of Lincoln and Garfield and the subsequent president's assassinations, three presidential assassinations in a row that happened sort of in the 1800s and into the 20th century. And what she does is she goes on holiday looking for all the various relics. Mm-hmm. And she goes to the places where these assassinations took place. So she goes to the location of the Ford's Theatre in Washington where Lincoln was shot. And, you know, she even travels the escape route that Booth took with a broken leg up to Dr. Mudd's house. You know, when I listen to audiobooks, historical stuff fascinates me, you know. Really does.
I believe it's your alter ego who's going to appear tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. No, I kind of started on my career under the name Porky the Poet in 1983. And so I started writing poetry again about 7-8 years ago. Well, kind of, I never stopped really. I got the odd commission in there, but I kind of stopped at the end of the 80s, early 90s, and then did more stand-up. But they've come back to the poetry in recent years, and it's fun to write. I've got a very singular style. but I like, I just the bounce of words is what I like. And so, yes, I'm doing a Porky the Poet show tomorrow, yeah.
And going back to your early career and with the Force Awakens coming out, do you think you'll ever revive your Star Wars routine?
You know, that's something that obviously, you know, it would be, career-wise, it would probably be the sensible thing to do, but no, I'm one of those, it's a bit like in the book talk today, I spoke about how I loved the fact that A.A. Milne could have carried on doing Winnie the Pooh stories ad infinitum, really, but he stopped after two books. But the moment Christopher Robin grew up is sort of actually chronicled, and it's so lovely that those books stop. And I think that everything has a finite span in terms of sort of ideas, and that Star Wars show was something that I wanted to do at the time. So when I started it, it was three or four gags in the middle of a 20-minute routine. Within a month, it was the whole 20 minutes. A month after that, it was 45 minutes. A year after that, it was a one-hour Edinburgh show. And then, after the UK tour, and then I did three nights at the Lyric in Hammersmith, it was longer than the film. And that, to me, was kind of, you know what? You've said everything. Now it's longer than the film. I think you're done. Because I only talked about the first original, the film everyone calls Star Wars, which the nerds call A New Hope. That episode 4, that's what I talk about, is just that one, because that to me was the most, it's the story. And we know it's a story because it's the Searchers. It's the Searchers redone in space is what it is. So yeah.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and Phil Jupitus. That abridged audiobook version of Good Morning Nantwich, Adventures in Breakfast Radio, is available commercially, as are the print and ebook versions. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.